So let's start off with what your research was about. I'd like you to tell my listeners why you thought it was important to do.
Sure, yes, with pleasure. So we're kind of in a glut of information. We see and read lots of different information every day, but increasingly we don't necessarily have as much trust or confidence in the information we consume, in part because some of the information is being created by bots and trolls and other people or machines that don't necessarily have our best interests at heart. So I think as we're getting more into content being created by machines or bad actors, if you will, we need to be a little bit more cautious with our media consumption routines. So I was trying to look at with generative AI, which is a relatively new technology, how newsrooms and journalists are using generative AI technologies in their day-to-day workflows, if at all. That's kind of a big preview of the research, yeah.
It's mainly to do with looking at large outlets in, well, you do it in seven countries, but they're European, USA, and Australia. And there are considerable differences, aren't there, between those outlet outfits, aren't there?
There are, yes. If you look at those three regions, they are quite different regions. I think from what I've seen and heard, European Union and folks in Europe tend to be the most progressive and advanced with regard to regulating AI. So they have more kind of governance and legislation in place to try to govern how AI is used in society. The States has its executive order that President Biden recently issued. And I think in Australia, we're still a little bit at the back of the pack, still trying to get our heads around how best to regulate AI. The government has this working group that it's put together to try to start thinking about this. We don't really have any legislation yet about how to regulate AI in our current context. So I think there's still some work to be done with how we regard and react to AI here in Australia.
Now, the thing about journalism, a lot of the stuff that around journalism has focused on the textual, concept of fake news and all the rest of it. But when it comes to pictures, there's the old adage, a picture doesn't lie, that sort of stuff. But in actual fact, AI can depict things that haven't happened, and they can create people that never existed.
Absolutely right, Annie. It can, yes. So it is true that it can, edit images. We saw that with the Georgie Purcell case in Victoria. We saw Channel 9 getting caught out for using AI to edit and expand the borders of an image's frame. And in doing so, it kind of gave her a midriff that was exposed that wasn't there in real life. That made it kind of a more sexualized, provocative image than what she was actually wearing. So we saw AI being used to edit images, but also, as you mentioned, AI can also be used to create images. So you can, with just a few words, you can describe whatever kind of image you want to see, and AI can try to generate an image that returns results that align with what you're trying to describe and see. So it can be something very innocuous. It can be, I want to see, cattle on a hill, or it can be something really a lot more potentially dangerous. You could say, this world leader engaging in really close talks, and perhaps those are warring nations or something, and it's not good for those two folks to be seen together. You can really kind of imagine how this could be used for ill purposes.
And in actual fact, it's a bit like using journalism as advertising. Once you've seen something, you can't unsee it, basically. It's a kind of a, has a, the same ring as gossip.
Yes. We do cognitively process visuals really quickly, so 60,000 times faster than text. So they are really good at lightning fast getting our attention and sticking in our brains. They also are really oftentimes very much more emotionally resonant than text. So when you see something, you oftentimes feel something viscerally, emotionally. You react to it in a different way than when you're reading about something. So that's why I think advertisers, marketers, and other types of media professionals do tend to rely on lots of visuals because they are more kind of peripherally and heuristically processed compared to text, which tends to be more kind of logically and rationally processed.
One of the things that's really interesting about your paper for me is the practical nature of describing what the text to image world is really about. Because I do things to do with film, the use of software to generate avatars for people in documentaries because people don't want to have their face. They want to remain anonymous, but they want them not just a voice, they want them as a physical entity. I'm not sure people realize just how sophisticated some of this technology has become. That's what my point. Because it's not just pictures, it's actually videos as well.
It is, yes, and that includes not just video but audio as well. You can use AI tools to quote unquote voice clone someone's voice. So if you have a little snippet of someone's voice speaking, this interview itself or someone's voice on YouTube or whatever the source is, you can extract that little bit of audio and then clone their voice and type in a message, and it will then AI will speak in that person's voice like the person normally speaks. We saw this just this week in Australia. Dr. Carl, the really well-known fellow who gives medical advice and talks about all sorts of different things, how the body works and that kind of thing. Scammers were taking his image and his likeness and his voice and using AI to create videos of him spruiking these health products that were of nebulous quality. And people were kind of caught up by this, and they're saying, well, it's Dr. Carl, he's credible, he's reputable, he's a trustworthy source, of course I'm going to believe what he says. But then it actually wasn't Dr. Carl at the end of the day, it was AI, acting as Dr. Carl. So it is not just still images, it is also audio, it is also video. It's very much multimedia being used now with AI in really sometimes really creative and interesting ways, but also sometimes very troubling ways.
It undermines the whole principle of journalism, which is apparently this connection with objectivity, with, in inverted commas, because that's another issue altogether. But there's this sort of relationship between the audience and the outlet that is apparently being violated, really.
I think these technologies and this software does, I think, make us a little bit more cynical. I think kind of just does erode some of the trust we have in people and public institutions potentially. And if we start to see what this technology can do, and we see people using it for bad uses, I think it does kind of make us more cynical about, well, are people or organizations that I trust, also using this and not telling me about it? It does kind of open up the door to doubt and suspicion and cynicism. So I think it is a little bit troubling that we haven't kind of gotten our heads around how best to use the technologies and use them in an ethical way.
Well, yeah, and that's what you did find out. You found that the people who were photo editors or people who are in that kind of role were troubled, in fact. And there's only a certain amount of them that have organizations that have actively got policies as they try and figure out how they can use AI in a way that can save them money effectively.
And that's not in and of itself a bad thing. We all want to
No,
do our
no.
jobs more quickly if we can. But I think it does start to become problematic if you are misleading or deceiving people, or people are not getting the context they need, or making decisions based on the information you're providing, if that information isn't accurate in and of itself. So I think there are definitely places for guardrails and principles and policies that should be put in place so that these organizations can use these tools to make their jobs, easier or faster, as long as it's not impacting the quality of the information that's going out and that people are then making decisions on.
And I suppose that's what I was getting back to, the practicalities, because of the way the people who work in these areas, how they would use it. So there will be labour displacement with illustrators, for example. One thing that I was interested in was this kind of creation of a closed loop society, because as you talk about creating, when you go to a photojournalistic sort of image, you talk about how the AI is trained using a pool of images. That's really fascinating.
Happy to chat more about that. So these text-to-image generators or text-to-video generators or text-to-text generators, all of them, work by getting trained on really massive sets of data. So we're talking, you know, millions of articles or millions of videos or millions of photos. And that trained data really, really matters because if you're trying to ask AI to generate an image of, you know, a person in a library, more often than not, if you just put that prompt into a generator, person in a library, it will return a quite biased result. It'll have a, you know, maybe three or four of the results are men, probably there three or four of them are light-skinned, probably all of them are able-bodied, they're probably all in a quite urban environment, they're probably all middle-aged. So there's some things where AI, you know, doesn't really have as much data to draw on, and therefore it's kind of perpetuating existing imbalances in society. And so if we don't really have representative training data, you know, images of people with disabilities or people who are quite young or quite old, then it can't really as well and as easily draw on those types of folks and represent them by default. When we do want to have, you know, representative information environment, we want to have all sorts of different people represented in our news and media. And so AI oftentimes isn't helping with that because of the training data it's drawing on or because of the workforce composition of software engineers and computer scientists. A lot of them are male, older men. And so their biases and worldviews are also kind of sometimes being implicitly bundled up into the algorithms that are then being used in AI generation.
Oh, goodness, that's such a way of brainwashing a whole society, actually.
Yeah. It's a bit daunting, a bit sobering.
Yeah, very sobering, I reckon. The other thing on a practical level was, of course, the issue of copyright.
It is a massive issue. It's still very much a question mark and an unsolved issue in many jurisdictions, including here in Australia. So as we mentioned, AI generators work by getting trained on all these millions of images or videos or documents. But oftentimes they're getting trained on copyrighted millions of photos or videos or documents. And so it's still very much a big question mark who owns the copyright, if copyright exists at all, for the outputs of AI tools. So all the different artists and producers and illustrators and whoever else is contributing training data, many of them unwillingly, oftentimes just getting kind of crawled and trolled from the websites online, not necessarily artists are giving up their data for training data, just kind of taken without permission. That is a really big issue that's working its way through the courts in so many different jurisdictions, both in the States, in Europe, and here in Australia as well. I think Japan is a bit different in that Japan said that it's not going to enforce copyright on AI output material. So that's a bit of an outlier. But I think here in Australia and in the States, we're still kind of working our way through how that will work.
Well, there's an interesting thing that you point out about different jurisdictions. In the UK, for example, they have an audience member can challenge something published by a news outlet under an accuracy regulatory clause. Now, that's really fascinating, isn't it?
It is. And like you were saying, AI can create images of things that didn't happen or people that didn't exist. And so there's heaps of scope there for those challenges to come into play. People can say this person didn't exist, this thing didn't happen. And news outlets, if they're using these images or videos, could be caught out for doing that under that accuracy clause. So there are heaps of regulatory issues to be aware of and to try to be thoughtful about when you're making AI images or AI video.
Well, you found that when you actually asked all these different people, or you know, had conversations with people working in this field, that they were actually really pleased that you put out this paper because it added to the reflection on an area that is happening right at this moment, but really they haven't really grappled with properly.
Yeah, and I think that's just the nature of journalism. It's a very fast-paced profession. It's never ending. It's always on. It's, you know, 24/7. The news never sleeps, that kind of thing. So as journalists and working media professionals, we don't really get a lot of time to just sit back and critically reflect and think about new technology or new developments happening in industry and how we can respond to those. So I think just kind of the full-on nature of the profession doesn't get that opportunity very often. I think also journalists are sometimes siloed in their organizations. They're in very distinct teams. They don't have a lot of necessarily cross collaboration with other teams or with other news outlets across the sector. And so hopefully this type of research can help kind of bring people together and to see, here's how my outlet's doing this. How's your outlet doing it? And kind of letting you look across and learn from each other at a kind of industry-wide level.
It's interesting also because it's an academic piece. I love the way you do things like define what a code of conduct are for, which is to manage relationships with and obligations to audience. So, I mean, that's how they would see the answer to the problems that are raised by the issue, the ethical issues of AI, I guess.
So I think you're picking up on a really good point. I think to consume news and media from who knows who on social media, but to really kind of thoughtfully think about, am I consuming news from an organization that has transparent principles and ethical codes of conduct that govern how they operate? And kind of putting your attention and trust and focus on those types of sources compared to strange accounts online that who knows who they are, where they're from, what kind of ethical principles they have, if any. I think it's good to kind of think about where you're getting your news and information from and the ethics of that.
It was funny the thing about Elon Musk. Not that there's anything laugh out loud about Elon Musk, but how he not only changed the name of Twitter to X, but also said that he wasn't going to have any of headlines or source material for any of the images, etc., which he had to backtrack on.
Yes, it is really, I think, interesting, and I'm glad they have backtracked on that particular topic, that point, because you can appreciate if you're scrolling through, social media on our small screens as many of us do, you're looking at a lot of posts in a short amount of time. They're all kind of small. There's not a lot of context. When you get rid of the headlines, there's even less context. And so if the New York Times or the ABC or whatever reputable news outlet you're looking at is reporting on an AI image that's gone viral, you don't have that context without the headline to say this is an AI image. And so you can easily get kind of misled and think that the AI that the New York Times or ABC is republishing AI content without being transparent when they're reporting on it if they don't have that kind of context in the headline. So I think headlines are really important, and having them available to be watched and read on social media feeds is quite important.
Is there anything else I should have asked you or that you'd like to say?
I think just maybe just one more thought about kind of just media literacy,
Yeah.
because I think a lot of these issues seem like they're really far away or really hard to tackle. And you have big tech companies, you have governments, you have all these different players in the ecosystem. But as an individual citizen, you or me, we can't really do a lot to affect policy change or how big tech companies operate. But I think just kind of thinking about, well, in terms of media literacy, what do I know about how images are made, how they're edited, where I'm getting my information from, the policies and principles that inform how that information is made. I think just kind of having a little bit more of a think about your own critical media use is good. And then just kind of going back to trusted sources, trying to figure out for yourself, what are these sources that I can trust? Why can I trust them? Have they kind of had reliable content over time? Or is this a new source to me? Do I have a relationship with the source? That kind of thing. I think asking those kind of questions hopefully helps us be a bit more empowered to be a little bit more active in our democracy and in our information landscape.
Thank you very much for talking to me.
Thank you, Annie. Great to chat with you.